from persuading them to fund it. Here, Spruill faced continued resistance. Legislators balked at giving Spruill any money at all, claiming they couldn't fund a new program while existing agencies were being asked to slash their budgets. By the end of the session, the legislature had refused to appropriate any funds at all for the new death investigation system it had just approved. In 1982, Spruill pled her case to the Senate Appropriations Committee. She highlighted the virtues of a modern medical examiner system, from solving murders to monitoring public health. But her exchanges with committee members grew contentious. Previously, she had clashed on several occasions with State Senator Robert Crook, one of the state's more powerful lawmakers. Crook had been around a long time, long enough to have defeated civil rights icon Fannie Lou Hamer when she ran for the seat in 1971, and to have worked closely with former sheriff and state senator Henry Strider. Strider was sheriff of Tallahatchie County during the Emmett Till murder and trial. He'd made a name for himself in the national media by walking into court each morning during the Till trial and greeting members of the black press the same way each day. Hello, niggers. In 1966, in response to a tough agricultural market, Crook and Strider co-sponsored a bill that would have relocated black farmers from Mississippi to other states in order to free up jobs for white farmers. This was the man Spruill kept butting up against, the main opposition to her plan. Spruill threatened to resign unless she got the funding she needed to both do her job properly and implement the new system the legislature had already approved. Dr. Lloyd White, who himself would be appointed Mississippi State Medical Examiner several years later, attended the hearing. He and Crook weren't friends, but did have a cordial professional relationship. According to White, Crook approached him after the hearing to vent about Spruill. He seemed enraged that she had taken such a tone with the esteemed Appropriations Committee, and he seemed particularly offended to have been challenged by a woman. "Well, I'll tell you what we did," Crook told White. "We just cut her tits off. She won't be coming here trying to tell us what to do anymore." Crook made good on his vow. He wasn't about to let a woman push him around. By the summer of 1982, not only had the legislature still not funded the new system, it had cut off all funding to Spruill's office, including her salary. Calls to Spruill's state office phone reached a recording indicating that the number had been disconnected. Though she had no office, staff, phone, or salary, Spruill was still the state medical examiner. She continued her oversight of the coroners and continued lobbying for funding to restore her office and implement her reforms. Incredibly, she stayed on the job for another 13 months with no pay. She finally resigned in July 1983 after the state legislature once again refused to fund her office. Asked for comment on Spruill's resignation, state officials said they were surprised and shocked, despite the fact that she had worked for more than a year without a paycheck or a phone. Within weeks of Spruill's resignation, the state had returned to the status quo. Law enforcement officials complained that they had to go out of state to find competent forensic pathologists. Clinical pathologists wanted no part of conducting autopsies or testifying in murder cases. Coroners remained untrained, underpaid, and incapable of leading a modern death investigation. And state media went back to describing Mississippi as a sanctuary for murderers. At the time of Spruill's resignation, 11 of the state's 82 coroners still couldn't read or write. The following year, the state legislature passed a bill that placed the medical examiner's office under the authority of the state crime lab, which itself worked under the Department of Public Safety, DPS. The department would have to fund the position from its existing budget. DPS scraped together $150,000. It wasn't nearly enough to fund what the state needed, a qualified forensic pathologist, an assistant or two, and an operational office, but it was something, and it was desperately needed. A study of Mississippi death investigations from 1981 through 1984 showed staggeringly high rates of deaths classified as undetermined causes. In DeSoto County, for example, the rate was 53%. In Benton County, it was 70%. The average across the country is around 3%. In spite of all these challenges, in April 1985, Mississippi hired its second state medical examiner. Dr. Thomas Bennett, young, earnest, and mustachioed, had been the state medical examiner in Iowa. His salary would be $67,000, modest for the position, and Bennett began with an office budget of $147,000, a fraction of what other well-funded medical examiner offices were allocated in other states. Still, Mississippi state officials greeted Bennett with a bacchanal of self-congratulation. Police chiefs, prosecutors, and various heads of agencies threw a party when he arrived. Bennett, they declared, was walking, talking evidence that Mississippi was finally upgrading its death investigation system. The elation over such a modest step, filling an office that had been vacant for 7.5 of the 9 years it had existed, bordered on parody. Commissioner of Public Safety James Roberts proclaimed, "The potential murderers in Mississippi have been sent a message." And yet, odd as it was, Bennett's warm Mississippi greeting lasted only a matter of hours. The state of Iowa, where Bennett had just come from, had eliminated the office of coroner in 1959. So Mississippi's coroners viewed Bennett's hiring as a direct threat to their continued existence. At a luncheon with coroners later that day, the Clarion Ledger reported that Bennett was greeted with cold stares and blunt talk. Lincoln County Coroner Morris Henderson warned Bennett that every death investigation must go through him and him only. He told the new hire that he was to have no communication with anyone else in the county. "If I hear you told the sheriff anything, that's it." Another coroner was blunter still. "We're going to be hard on you," he said. Despite the uncomfortable welcome, once they were sure he wasn't going to eliminate the office, the Coroner's Association, now headed by Hinds County Coroner Robert Martin, warmed to Bennett, at least initially. Martin and Bennett first worked together to persuade the legislature to pass the Mississippi Coroner Reorganization Act of 1986, the first major change to the state's coroner law in nearly a century. Under the new law, the state medical examiner would determine who could conduct autopsies in the state, or if necessary, perform some autopsies himself. The law also changed the requirements to run for coroner. It bumped the coroner's pay from $20 per death investigation to $50, and did away with the requirement to round up stray livestock and the requirement that coroners believe in a supreme being. Finally, the law required that the state medical examiner be board certified in forensic pathology. That's a pretty standard requirement for medical examiners across the country, but it would become the source of a lot of controversy in Mississippi. The law was an improvement, but still left a lot of problems. It lacked teeth, and in the years since, many of the requirements haven't been well enforced. And in not doing away with the office of coroner entirely, the law in some ways reestablished the state's commitment to coroner-led death investigations. At least one of the state's coroners understood the problem. When the Clarion Ledger asked Marion County Coroner Ed Laird what he made of the new law, he replied, "Do you think 1 week's training is going to make a medical examiner out of anybody?" If Bennett's hiring initially drew the ire of the state's coroners, his work with Martin on the new law divided them. At one time, the Mississippi State Coroners Association represented over 60% of the county coroners. By the end of 1986, the relatively progressive group only represented about a third. Many of the coroners who hadn't joined didn't meet the new requirements, although they would still be grandfathered in, and resented the implication that the office needed modernization. They also resented the notion that they needed oversight. Some told Bennett to stay in Jackson rather than visit their crime scenes personally. They didn't want him looking over their shoulders. Some also fought his attempts to assert his authority when he disagreed with how they were handling an investigation, or went around him when they didn't like his diagnosis. As Bennett settled into office, he began to see firsthand just how bad the system could be. Even the coroners who had supported him could show astonishingly bad judgment. In 1986, Bennett clashed with Martin over the death of a 17-year-old girl. Bennett concluded from his autopsy that while he couldn't rule out death by strangulation, he also couldn't say for sure that it was the manner of her death. It was the sort of careful, nuanced diagnosis that science sometimes demands, but that police and prosecutors find unhelpful. Martin and the local sheriff wanted more, so they took the body to a doctor Martin had used for autopsies in the past, a psychiatrist who had a medical degree but wasn't board certified in forensic pathology. The three men then drove the body to a country road where the doctor performed a bizarre roadside autopsy. According to press reports, after a procedure lasting less than an hour, the doctor told Martin that the woman had definitely been strangled. The same year, Bennett got into another public fight with coroner Ed Laird after Laird delivered a severed head to Bennett's office. When Bennett asked for an explanation, an investigator in the local DA's office said that he and Laird had decided the body to which the head had once been attached was too smelly and infested with bugs for examination. So Laird simply pulled out a knife and sawed off the head. According to Bennett, Laird had confirmed the story to him over the phone. Appalled, Bennett moved to strip Laird of his position. Publicly, Laird denied the charge and claimed the head had fallen off on its own. In a well-staffed, well-equipped office, Bennett might have engaged those and other fights and more firmly established his office's authority under state law. But there just wasn't time for it. He had more than he could handle trying to keep up with the coroners who were cooperating with him. 4 months into the job, he was putting in 80-hour work weeks and had personally performed 104 autopsies. That's a rate of 312 per year. Lamar Burroughs, president of the Mississippi Pathologist Association, remarked in the Clarion Ledger, "That's just about more than any one person can handle." Burroughs's comment is notable. Within a decade, the state would have a medical examiner performing six times that figure. But Bennett's pace had begun wearing him down after just 4 months, and he hadn't even yet begun regularly testifying in court, a time-consuming task that required preparation, travel, and waiting around to be called to the witness stand. Moreover, he was forced to perform his autopsies at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, a facility that wasn't equipped for forensic pathology. He was also working with a state crime lab that was frequently backlogged, forcing him to wait on test results before delivering his reports to coroners, prosecutors, and the families of the deceased. Though it was through no fault of his own, that created more tension between him and county officials. By June 1986, Bennett had not only pushed through the first major reform of the state's coroner system in a century, but also reduced the state's percentage of deaths from unknown causes from 46% to just 2%. But he was also frustrated and burned out. He was short-staffed, worked untenable hours, and wasn't getting much support from the DPS. At the end of September 1986, Bennett finally resigned. "I cannot shoulder the burden anymore. I'm just fried," he told the Clarion Ledger. One of the state's more reform-minded coroners worried that Bennett would be impossible to replace. "It would surprise me if they find somebody to come in under the same conditions," said Harrison County Coroner Steve Delahousie. "Mississippi doesn't have a very good track record with medical examiners." As Bennett left, the same state officials who had warmly welcomed him a year and a half earlier took potshots at him, accusing him of jumping ship. When the position remained vacant a month later, DPS Commissioner James Roberts played down the importance of having a state medical examiner at all. "I'm not aware of any problem," he said. "Most district attorneys and people who have the need to have autopsies are able to get them, so the system will continue to function." But most local officials had returned to using clinical or anatomical pathologists, not forensic pathologists. The quality of investigations had undoubtedly diminished. The system had regressed. Fay Spruill was initially encouraged at Bennett's success in pushing through the coroner reform law in 1986. She then watched as he fought and lost the very battles she had fought and also lost. She told a reporter, I'm really just heartsick. In October 1986, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals issued a strongly worded, spectacularly flawed opinion in the case of State v. Stinson. 2 years earlier, Robert Lee Stinson had been convicted of raping and killing an elderly woman in Milwaukee. The only physical evidence linking him to the crime was the testimony of two bite mark specialists, Lowell Thomas Johnson and Raymond Rawson. At the time, Rawson served on the Bite Mark Standards Committee of the American Board of Forensic Odontology. He had also co-authored the organization's original guidelines for bite mark matching. Johnson performed the initial analysis in the case by placing a mold of the suspect's teeth over photographs of some marks on the victim's body. He concluded that the marks had to have been made by teeth identical in all of these characteristics to the teeth of Stinson. Rawson then reviewed those conclusions and confirmed that the marks matched Stinson's teeth to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. Stinson was convicted. On appeal, Stinson challenged the admission of the bite mark evidence. The appellate court shot him down. Based on the testimony from Johnson and Rawson, the appeals court judges went on for paragraphs about how careful and meticulous the two experts had been. Ultimately, the court found the bite mark evidence against Stinson so overwhelming as to exclude to a moral certainty every reasonable hypothesis of innocence. A moral certainty. Yet in 2009, 23 years after he was convicted, Robert Lee Stinson was exonerated by DNA testing. He had never bitten the victim, nor did he rape and kill her. All of the evidence that screamed guilt, to a moral certainty no less, was unfounded pseudoscience. Yet the court never made any effort to correct its mistake. As of this writing, State v. Stinson is still the controlling precedent for bite mark evidence in Wisconsin. Bite mark analysis, along with fields like tire tread analysis, tool mark matching, blood spatter analysis, and even fingerprint analysis, all belong to a class of forensics called pattern matching. These fields are problematic because although they're often presented to juries as scientific, they're actually entirely subjective. Analysts essentially look at two samples and determine, using their own judgment, whether or not they're a match. These analysts aren't subject to peer review or blind testing. There's no way to calculate error rates. You'll rarely find two experts who are diametrically opposed about a victim's blood type or how many DNA markers match the defendant. That's because those are questions of science. In pattern matching, expert witnesses regularly come to opposing conclusions. Juries are simply asked to side with the analyst they find more convincing. Bite mark matching really grew in popularity in U.S. courtrooms in the 1970s and 1980s, but it can be traced all the way back to the Salem witch trials. It literally began with a witch hunt. In May 1692, the Reverend George Burroughs was arrested in Salem on suspicion of witchcraft. The only physical evidence against him were several alleged bite marks found on some of the girls he was accused of corrupting with sorcery. At trial, Burroughs's mouth was pried open so his teeth could be compared to the marks left on the bodies of the girls. Burroughs actually had a solid alibi. At the time of the alleged attacks, he was in jail. That didn't matter much to his accusers. At the urging of the notorious witch hunter Cotton Mather, Burroughs was convicted, sentenced to death, and promptly hanged. 2 months later, the governor of Massachusetts called for an end to witchcraft trials. He issued a proclamation that prohibited the use of spectral and intangible evidence in the colony's criminal trials. 2 decades later, Burroughs was posthumously declared innocent, and the colony of Massachusetts compensated his children for their father's wrongful execution. So went the first recorded use of bite marks in a criminal trial. The most consequential bite mark case in U.S. history occurred in 1974, when a California judge convicted Walter Edgar Marks of voluntary manslaughter based largely on alleged bite marks on the victim's nose. The marks were identified only when the victim's body had been exhumed, more than 6 weeks after she had been autopsied, embalmed, and buried. After a truly macabre series of experiments that involved a plaster cast of the victim's nose, a Frankfurter, and an analyst biting a detective's nose for comparison, three dentists testified for the prosecution. All claimed they could match impressions on the victim's corpse to Marx's teeth. In a ruling that has since become enormously influential, a California appeals court upheld the conviction. Going forward, the Marx ruling will be read as a global warrant for court's acceptance of bite mark identification testimony. The Marx ruling was essentially an end run around the Frye test, the prevailing standard at the time for determining the validity of scientific evidence. The judges in Marx actually conceded that there was no scientific research to support bite mark matching. That should have been the end of the analysis. The evidence should have been tossed and the conviction overturned. Instead, the judge's reasoning took a bizarre turn. Because there was no science to analyze, the court decided a Frye test wasn't necessary. Instead, they simply invented their own test for evidence that wasn't scientific, but was imbued with what you might call a scientific gloss. They noted that the trial judge had ruled that the bite mark expertise seemed sound, and that was good enough for them. In essence, Marx introduced a new standard for the admission of forensic evidence, the eyeball test. 3 years later, another California appeals court cited Marx in upholding bite mark evidence in a separate case. Strangely, that court explicitly referenced the superior trustworthiness of the scientific bite mark approach described in Marx, despite the fact that the Marx opinion specifically acknowledged a lack of scientific research in support of the practice. There would be no going back. There was now an established record of precedent. There would soon also be an established record of wrongful convictions. In the 13 years following the Marx ruling, 16 court opinions from 12 states either relied on the decision or adopted its eyeball test. All but three of those rulings noted the scientific nature of bite mark analysis, despite the fact that, again, the Marx decision itself explicitly acknowledged that scientific research validating the field didn't exist. It was like an extended exercise in jurisprudential telephone, the childhood game in which a phrase is gradually corrupted as each kid whispers it to the next. In 1978, the Arizona Supreme Court became the first state high court to hold that bite mark evidence of this sort is an admissible forensic discipline. By 1988, the West Virginia Supreme Court noted in an opinion that bite mark matching had been so generally accepted in American courtrooms as sound science that a Frye analysis was no longer even necessary. There still wasn't a shred of scientific evidence to back any of it up. Instead, courts were upholding bite mark evidence based on little more than previous rulings from other courts, stretching all the way back to Marx. In some instances, state appellate courts adopted the eyeball test. In others, the courts erroneously claimed that Marx had already validated the science of bite mark matching, thus relieving them from engaging in any analysis themselves. It's been one big judicial echo chamber. Most of the time when doing one of these analyses, the only thing a judge will ask is, "Have other courts allowed this?" Says Arizona State University law professor and evidence expert Michael Sachs. If the answer is yes, then they'll figure out a way to let it in. Or they'll decide that if the government is paying a person to do this analysis, it must be legitimate. That's a far cry from an analysis of its scientific merit, but it doesn't seem to matter. By 1987, 23 state appellate courts had accepted bite mark analysis without a single dissenting opinion. By 2004, courts in 37 U.S. jurisdictions had accepted it. As of this writing, in 2017, no court in America has yet upheld a challenge to the scientific validity of bite mark evidence. And yet the field has been denounced by every panel of scientists that has attempted to assess its scientific validity. Perhaps more pertinent, 25 people arrested or convicted primarily based on bite mark matching have been exonerated. Two of them were nearly executed. The late 1980s brought a spike in violent crime, along with a drumbeat of demagoguery from politicians. With more crime came more fear of crime. Cops and prosecutors sought new tools to help them put violent offenders behind bars. Politicians and much of the public itself were eager to give them those tools. DNA testing wasn't yet common, and the more targeted and sophisticated DNA testing we know today was still years away. The country was blissfully unaware of the coming wave of exonerations. The scientific community had yet to take much of an interest in forensics, and most Americans still believed that the criminal justice system was either infallible or pretty darn close. Given these conditions, and given the court's reluctance to provide any real oversight of the use of expert testimony, a forensic specialist willing to bend his or her analysis to confirm the suspicions of cops and prosecutors could do very well, financially and professionally. And many did. The exonerations wrought by DNA testing have now exposed too many crime lab scandals to count. But a truly enterprising showman, one with some charisma and some bravado, might push the boundaries. He might go beyond fudging test results or tweaking lab reports. He might invent new disciplines from whole cloth, concoct new methods of analysis, and claim expertise and powers of observation that only he possesses, all of which he could offer up to help law enforcement officials solve crimes and win convictions. Such a showman could do quite well for himself. In Mississippi, one man would do all of those things. He'd charm police officers and prosecutors with bawdy wit and backslapping charm, then win them over by providing the scientific-ish evidence that confirmed their suspicions and clinched convictions. He'd also pollute the criminal justice system, help convict innocent people, and help guilty people go free. His name is Michael West. Meanwhile, three primary interests drove the evolution of Mississippi's death investigation system in the 1970s and 1980s. First and foremost was the state legislature, a body unwilling to appropriate a budget to build proper facilities and hire the forensic pathologists and support staff needed to run a modern-day state medical examiner's office. It was a body also beset with cronyism, still tainted with old-school chauvinisms like misogyny and mistrust of outsiders, as Spruill and Bennett found out, and populated by lawmakers with a stubborn aversion to change. Second were the coroners, defenders of a dinosaur institution, fiercely protective of the office, and still powerful enough as a group to beat back any proposed reforms that threatened their authority. Some at least recognized a few of the problems with the system and sought to upgrade the office itself, but no matter how well-intended those measures, they served only to perpetuate the status quo. Finally, there was law enforcement, the state's police officials and prosecutors. Though some law enforcement leaders recognized early on that a real medical examiner system might provide a more accurate read on the crime rate, some also realized that doing so might expose a shocking number of unsolved murders. But for the most part, until the late 1980s, the law enforcement community in Mississippi was one of the most reliable lobbies for real substantive reform. That would soon change. Fay Spruill and Thomas Bennett were doctors. They tried to create a death investigation system grounded in professional standards and medical science, regardless of how the results of such a system might affect those three main interest groups. When they encountered resistance, they adapted and tried to operate within the state's political landscape. But in the end, their fight was the same fight the medical community had been having with the justice system for decades. Change required some political acuity. Sheriff, district attorney, coroner, and legislator are all elected positions. By running for one of those positions, a candidate has already shown an interest in politics. By winning, he or she has already shown a knack for it. Doctors aren't normally political animals, and the profession is, generally, incompatible with the character traits that make for successful politicians. But what if a doctor came along who actually had some political acumen? A doctor who could simultaneously please the coroners by making them feel needed and legitimate, law enforcement by helping them get convictions, and state legislators by taking the entire problem and the problem of funding it off their plates, could very quickly accumulate power, influence, and money. Such a doctor would need to be comfortable with a massive workload, a workload professional medical organizations say would be impossible to maintain without sacrificing quality and professionalism. But so long as all the people in power were satisfied, no one who mattered would complain. He would need to seem authoritative and persuasive to juries, and he'd need to be persuasive even when giving scientifically dubious testimony or testimony well outside his area of expertise. Just before his resignation, Thomas Bennett told the Clarion Ledger that the political challenges and strain on his family posed by his workload were just too much to bear. "I wanted to stay here so badly," he said. But the state had asked far too much of him. "You're not going to get some clown to come in here and do the load I've been doing," he said. With that, the stage was set for Stephen Hayne. Chapter 6. Rise of a Fiefdom. It is certain in any case that ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy justice can have. James Baldwin, No Name in the Street. Among the witnesses whom Park Morris has deposed over the years, Stephen Hayne sticks in his memory more than most. In October 2007, the Memphis-based attorney was representing the estate of a man who had died of dehydration in a nursing home. The family had hired Hayne to do the autopsy before retaining Morris. The opposing attorneys and Morris had just questioned Hayne in a deposition. "I'm a Civil War buff," Morris says, "so as I was in his office talking to him, I noticed that Hayne had a shelf full of Civil War books. I pulled a book off the shelf at random. I can't remember what we had been talking about, but he told me to turn to a particular page because there was a quote there that was relevant to our conversation. I turned to the page, and I'll be damned. There it was. The guy had a photographic memory." Morris says it was immediately obvious that Hayne was not only smart, but he seemed to enjoy demonstrating just how smart he was. Others have noticed this, too. In a 2013 article about Hayne, New York Times reporter Campbell Robertson wryly observed that when he tried to interview Hayne about the controversy surrounding his work, their conversation ranged from the fall of the Roman Republic to the folly of the Vietnam War. "Brilliant guy, no question," Morris says. "And then I realized, that's what makes him so dangerous." Morris had deposed Hayne earlier that day. He found Hayne's answers surprising and more than a little disturbing. "When someone dies of dehydration," Morris says, "lab tests should show elevated levels of certain chemicals such as sodium. This patient's lab results were off the charts. I've investigated more than 2,500 nursing home deaths before and since, and I've still never seen anything like it." But despite those test results, Hayne insisted instead that the patient had died of amitriptyline poisoning. Amitriptyline is commonly used as an antidepressant and antipsychotic, but it can be toxic in large doses. Lab tests did show elevated levels of the drug in the deceased patient, but Morris says other tests conclusively showed that the high levels were due to a process called postmortem redistribution. After death, drugs can settle and become concentrated in certain areas of the body. That can skew lab results. Morris found himself in an ethical quandary. Hayne's claims actually helped Morris's client, but Morris also knew Hayne was wrong. He had previously hired three separate toxicologists, all of whom definitively told him that amitriptyline wasn't a factor in the man's death. He's just too smart to not have known. I think he calculated. I remember that he first seemed unprepared for the deposition, but as it got going, he seemed to assess the situation, the attorneys, the parties, what was at stake. Then he tailored his testimony on the fly to fit what he was observing. It was a remarkable thing. The two men made small talk after the deposition. When Morris mentioned his love of cars, Hain asked if Morris wanted to see his. Morris agreed and followed Hain to the parking lot. It was an all-black car. I think it was a Dodge Charger that he had souped up to look like an undercover police car, Morris says. Here was this short, kind of fat, 60-something-year-old man, and he's driving a car with decked-out rims, radios, and one of those spotlights that you can control from inside the car. Morris knew that Hain frequently testified in criminal cases, almost always for prosecutors. It looked so out of character. Here's this little bit geeky guy driving around in this muscly, not-so-undercover cop car. It was definitely the car of a guy with a complex. Morris says he initially couldn't put his finger on what bothered him about it all. The following morning, he read an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal detailing Hain's mammoth workload, questionable methods, and testimony he had given in several cases that other experts said was dubious. A chill went down my spine, Morris says. I thought, that's it. I started to see the big picture. Prosecutors in the South, they have this sort of jockish way about them. They're macho. You got the sense that Hain latched onto them because he liked associating with them. I'm sure he made a lot of money over the years, but he also got to be one of the guys. He got to drive the cool car, and they had a smart guy who would play ball. Hain has consistently denied that he would play ball for prosecutors. It was all of that, combined with Hain's intellect, that Morris found particularly alarming. I'm not some left-winger. I'm a pretty solid conservative, almost across the board. But I started wondering how many innocent people this guy might have put in prison. It was a terrifying thought. According to Morris, attorneys on both sides of the nursing home case agreed that Hain's testimony was way off base. The case was settled out of court. Almost 9 years and hundreds of cases later, Morris still remembers that encounter with Hain. The guy was brilliant. He also managed to be both insecure and an egomaniac. I remember thinking that seemed like a really dangerous combination in an expert witness. Stephen Timothy Hain was born in Los Angeles, California on August 30, 1941. He went to high school in the Bay Area. In 1967, at age 26, he enrolled in Contra Costa College in San Pablo, California. After 2 years, he transferred to North Dakota State University to study agriculture. About his choice of transfer school, Hain has explained that his decision was simple. Their application was one sheet, one side, and I decided that's the kind of school I wanted to go to. I liked their attitude. Before completing his undergraduate degree, Hain transferred to the University of North Dakota Medical School in 1972, where he studied for 2 years before transferring again to the medical school at Brown University in Rhode Island. This time, expediency gave way to prestige. He would later tell attorneys in a deposition, "I didn't want to graduate with a degree from the University of North Dakota. I wanted an Ivy League degree." He completed medical school in the spring of 1976. According to his trial and deposition testimony over the years, Hain's first postgraduate internship followed that same year at the Letterman Army Medical Center at the Presidio in San Francisco, where he specialized in pathology. After completing his internship and rotations at medical institutions in the Bay Area, he was named chief of pathology at the Blanchfield Army Hospital in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. He then moved around for a few years, from the military hospital in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, to a position as a reference pathologist at Shoals Medical Laboratories in Alabama, then to medical director of Rankin Medical Center Laboratory in Brandon, Mississippi, just east of Jackson. He received his Mississippi medical license in 1985 and obtained his certification in clinical and anatomical pathology from the American Board of Pathology soon after. Hain regularly began performing autopsies for the state of Mississippi in late 1986 or very early 1987. It was a propitious time to get started. Thomas Bennett had just quit the medical examiner post in frustration, the second state medical examiner in only a few years to do so. The state had reverted to administering autopsies the way it had for decades, but in an ever-increasing atmosphere of need. If the county coroner believed a suspicious death required an autopsy, he or she would hire a private pathologist. At the start of Hain's career, the fees that came with these referrals were around $400 for the autopsy itself, plus $200 per hour for preparation and time in court. Toward the end, the autopsy fee was around $1,000, and he was charging $350 or more per hour for testimony. He'd also get additional money for lab work and analysis. Each county was responsible for paying the doctors it hired for autopsies. All the while, the problem of too few qualified medical examiners to handle an increasing number of autopsies wasn't just intractable, it was getting worse. This was the context in which Hain rose to prominence. Where other pathologists in Mississippi saw forensic autopsies as a burden that cost them time and money, Stephen Hain found a way to make them profitable. The secret was to do a lot of them. Hain began his forensic pathology career in Mississippi with just a few autopsies per month, but his workload quickly escalated. In 1988, 2 years after moving to the state, he did 320. By the early 1990s, he was doing 1,200 per year, about 80% of the state's annual autopsy referrals. The number continued to rise from there, peaking in 2007 at 1,857 autopsies. Assuming he worked every day of the year, that's 5 per day. To put these numbers into perspective, the National Association of Medical Examiners, NAME, the leading professional organization for forensic pathologists, recommends a medical examiner do no more than 250 autopsies per year. If a physician exceeds 325 in a year, NAME won't certify the lab where that doctor works, regardless of any other factors. In a 2001 deposition, Hain admitted that in 1998 alone, over a period of just a few weeks, he performed 375 autopsies. He had done more autopsies in 11 weeks than NAME's uppermost limit for a year. But according to Hain, performing autopsies wasn't his only job. For most of his tenure in Mississippi, he also held two other professional responsibilities: medical director of the Rankin County Medical Center Laboratory and medical director of a kidney care facility and research lab. Over the years, he also held titles at various labs and hospitals and consulted in civil cases, including performing private autopsies and testifying in court. Hain has tried to explain away his workload by claiming a near superhuman capacity for labor. "I normally sleep no more than 2 to 3 hours a day. I also work 7 days a week, not 5 days a week. I don't take holidays. I don't take vacations. So I work at a much more efficient level and much harder than most people. I was blessed with that and cursed with that, but that's what I carry with me, and I do work very, very hard," he said while testifying in a 2003 murder trial. He also testified, "I do not require much sleep. I choose to work." When asked about NAME's claim that after more than 350 autopsies, doctors are prone to carelessness and mistakes, Hain countered, "I have an ability to stay alert. I have an ability to work long hours, and I don't think I make those, that is, errors. And I think my record stands for itself." He would repeat this claim in other trials throughout his career when questioned about his workload. Because Hain held two other full-time positions, or at least positions that were supposed to be full-time, He typically conducted all of his autopsies at night, generally between the late evening and the wee hours of the morning. His penchant for knocking out 8 to 10 autopsies at hours when most people are sleeping only added a layer of macabre to his lore. Some back-of-the-envelope math shows just how busy Hain had to have been. Add up even the low estimates Hain at various points has claimed he spent on continuing education, court testimony, his 2 salaried jobs, and just a few hours of sleep, and it leaves about 3 hours per autopsy, assuming 1,500 autopsies per year. That's the absolute minimum most professional groups say is necessary. But that would have left Hain with no time, 0 hours for vacations, days off, weekends off, or sick days. It doesn't account for meals, commuting, socializing, showering, other personal health and grooming, time with his spouse, parenting, or a single hobby or interest. It assumes he didn't mow his own lawn, watch TV, go to the movies, or take a trip to the grocery store. And it doesn't account for the dozens of journal articles and conference presentations that he claims to have researched and written. Incredible as they are, even those numbers don't tell the whole story. Hain also did private autopsies and consulting for civil cases. He has testified in depositions for some of those cases. Beginning in the early 1990s, Hain also became the go-to medical examiner for several parishes in Louisiana, adding still more to his autopsy total. In fact, in a 2012 deposition, Hain acknowledged that there were a couple years where he topped 2,000 autopsies. As for how he managed it all, Hain claims he simply never took time off. "I guess I am a workaholic," he said in 2012. "I don't go on vacations, don't take weekends, don't take holidays, just the way I am. I don't go to barbecues and stuff." Hain was able to dominate Mississippi's autopsy referrals by being all things to all the important people. Whereas other pathologists in the state reluctantly agreed to perform autopsies, Hain embraced them and actively sought out referrals. While law enforcement officials found other pathologists reluctant, off-putting, and unhelpful, Hain made himself available to police and prosecutors, enthusiastically testified in court, and, most importantly, worked with prosecutors to help them win convictions they believed were justified. Medical examiners are supposed to be impartial finders of fact, but the incentives built into the system are clear. After a suspicious death, the coroner, district attorney, or police official takes the body to a medical examiner for autopsy. In most cases, they then tell the medical examiner what they thought happened. The medical examiner who returns with opinions that back up their hunch earns favor and gets more referrals. The medical examiner who says, "No, that isn't what happened," or, the more likely scenario, "There just isn't enough conclusive evidence for me to say that this is what happened," makes the sheriff or prosecutor's job more difficult, and perhaps makes them think twice before using the same doctor the next time. There needn't even be any intent to deceive or distort findings. It's human nature. If they have a choice in which medical examiner to use, over time prosecutors and police will gravitate toward the expert who makes their jobs easier. A properly designed system would work to eliminate these sorts of biases and misaligned incentives. The Mississippi system fed them. The ways in which prosecutors and other law enforcement officials have described Hain over the years provides further evidence of the problem. For example, John T. Kitchens, a former district attorney, state judge, and longtime Hain defender, told the New York Times in 2013, "I'm sure there's a lot of people that don't like Hain, but from a prosecutor's standpoint, I don't know anybody who didn't like him. He was always so helpful and useful to law enforcement." When Hain finally came under fire in the late 2000s, law enforcement officials wrote letters to show their support for him. Like Kitchens, many described what a great witness he had been. One prosecutor recalled a case in which, upon hearing Hain testify, one juror whispered to another, "He must be some kind of genius." The prosecutor also feared that criticism of Hain would lead to the courts being overloaded with convicted killers making fruitless claims of wrongful convictions. Another prosecutor noted he was completely satisfied with Hain's work and noted Hain's ability to make several court appearances in one day. Still another seemed downright distraught at the prospect of losing Hain. "It has always been a source of great comfort to me that Dr. Hain would be a witness in our murder cases," he wrote. "It is a big concern to me that I might have to go through the rest of my career as a prosecutor without Dr. Hain performing our autopsies." Prior to Hain, the perverse incentives in the referral process were less important. There were no forensic pathologists in the state, and the clinical pathologists didn't particularly want referrals. That system still had lots of problems, but they were different problems. Crimes were going unsolved. They weren't being solved with questionable expertise. With a little funding, the Mississippi legislature could have followed the lead of Florida, Maryland, and a number of other states by implementing a modern, accountable, well-funded medical examiner system. It was just never a priority. Shortly after Hain moved to Mississippi from Alabama in the mid-1980s, he visited with Rankin County Coroner Jimmy Roberts. After that meeting, Roberts began sending Hain autopsy referrals. It began a partnership that would last for 2 decades. The two men would make money together, and they'd become among the most powerful figures in the state. Roberts was first elected Rankin County Coroner in 1981. In an interview with the Clarion Ledger shortly after he was sworn in, Roberts gave a preview of the debate that would unfold in the years to come. At the time, the reform-minded Fay Sproul was serving as Mississippi's first state medical examiner. Roberts, described by the paper as tall and fragile-looking, insisted that the coroner was still a critical public office. He told the paper that under Sproul's proposed reforms, the counties wouldn't get a good return on the tax dollars they'd be sending to Jackson. "By keeping money in the county, it can be better accounted for," the article read, paraphrasing Roberts. As it would turn out, by "be better accounted for," Roberts meant benefit Jimmy Roberts. While working with an established, influential elected coroner like Roberts, Hain began to get more autopsy referrals from other coroners across the state. The relationship also helped Roberts. In the late 1980s, Roberts opened his own morgue and embalming business in the town of Pearl. As Hain collected more and more referrals, Roberts would charge the other counties a fee when Hain used the morgue to do those autopsies. Roberts would also get transportation costs for picking up bodies and bringing them to his facility. One former coroner recalls Roberts getting $150 per autopsy for use of his morgue, plus up to $2 per mile for transporting bodies. Once the body was in his morgue, he also became the practical choice to provide the family of the deceased with embalming services. It was a convenient arrangement. After the autopsy, he'd say to the funeral director or family, "Well, as long as I've got the body, why don't I embalm him?" says another longtime former coroner. "He made a lot of money hauling bodies all over the state." By 2005, one consultant estimated that Hinds County alone, the largest in the state, was paying Roberts and Hain $2 million per year for autopsies, facilities rental, and the transport of bodies. With Jimmy Roberts in his corner, it didn't take Hain long to corner the market on Mississippi autopsies. Unlike the reluctant doctors with whom coroners and prosecutors had to deal in the past, Hain gladly worked with cops, DAs, and coroners. He was cooperative and agreeable, didn't complain about testifying, and produced results, if not full reports, in a respectable period of time. Hain quickly made a name for himself, and it paid off. In June 1987, he was appointed interim state medical examiner. In announcing the appointment, the public safety commissioner touted Hain's numerous published articles, his time as a pathologist for the military, and his impressive resume. There was one problem. The state medical examiner was required by state law to be certified in forensic pathology by the American Board of Pathology, ABP, the discipline's nationally recognized certifying organization. This was part of the recent efforts to modernize the state's death investigation system. Hain was certified in clinical and anatomical pathology, which deals with determining deaths by natural causes such as disease, heart attack, or stroke. He was not certified by ABP in forensic pathology, which concerns deaths that have implications for the legal system. But the state was desperate to fill the position, and the state officials whose opinions mattered clearly wanted Hain. The public safety commissioner requested a legal opinion from the state attorney general asking whether an uncertified pathologist could be appointed state medical examiner if a certified candidate wasn't available. Faye Spruill was the only board-certified forensic pathologist in the state at the time. She didn't want the job, nor was anyone going to offer it to her. The attorney general's office answered that it could be done at least on an interim basis. That's how Stephen Hain became Mississippi's third state medical examiner. The arrangement didn't last long. In February 1988, 8 months after he was appointed, Hain resigned. He said no one had asked him to step down, but he was doing so in order to clear the way for the appointment of a permanent board-certified state medical examiner. With Hain out of the state medical examiner's office, and the office essentially defunct, the last few years of the 1980s spawned yet another public debate about the state of Mississippi's death investigation system. In August 1988, a legislative oversight group called the Joint Committee on Performance Evaluation and Expenditure Review, PEER, published a study and audit of the coroner system. The group found that the state medical examiner's office was understaffed and underfunded, that the state's autopsy facilities were woefully inadequate, and that county coroners were often unqualified, uncooperative, and deficient in their duties. It described the coroner system as outdated and inefficient, found that thousands of deaths were going uninvestigated or misinvestigated, and concluded that the entire process was corrupting the administration of justice. The Clarion Ledger followed up with a reported series called A Skeletal System. The problems outlined in the series had been articulated many times before, and the series quoted several experts and policymakers who advocated scrapping the coroner system for a medical examiner system, as other states had done. One article looked at why Mississippi lawmakers seemed so uninterested in going that route. Most said that funding a proper medical examiner system wasn't a priority for them because the voters who elected them didn't seem to care. One of the more notable opponents of moving to a medical examiner system, Stephen Hain, now in private practice. Hain told the paper, "Anyone that can talk about building a complete, statewide, totally funded system in the medical examiner's office needs to have their brain checked." Of course, a well-funded statewide medical examiner system would also have scuttled Hain's burgeoning autopsy business. By the end of the 1980s, Hain had significantly increased his share of the state's autopsy referrals. Most coroners embraced him, but he also quickly became the only game in town. Even the handful of officials who had reservations about him felt that their hands were tied. "I didn't like it," says one Mississippi coroner, explaining why he used Hain for autopsies over the years. "That was the system. I had to use the system because there was no other game." Douglas Posey, now a medical examiner in Houston, said in a 2007 interview that during the 1990s, he had offered to do some autopsies in Mississippi, but was rebuffed. "I remember the Washington County coroner told me that if I wanted to do autopsies in Mississippi, I had to get permission from Stephen Hain first," Posey said. "I thought that was odd, since Hain didn't hold any office." Most Mississippi officials either actively encouraged all of this or ignored it. But even among the few who both knew there was a problem and had the authority to do something about it, there was a sense of powerlessness. The late Jim Ingram, a former FBI agent, was the state's commissioner of public safety from 1992 to 2000. Ingram at first defended Hain, whom he at times called a friend. But he began to worry after Hain and West clashed with two successive state medical examiners. "We didn't see eye to eye," Ingram said of Hain in a 2006 interview. but most of the autopsies went to him. I can't say why. It's just what the coroners and prosecutors wanted. Over the years, Hain has given conflicting explanations for his resignation as interim state medical examiner. His explanation at the time, that he resigned so the state could begin searching for a